The question is, what happens to consciousness only partly developed, not quite Shiva, after death? Consciousness is no thing. How does the word consciousness come into the language at all? What we actually experience is a living person, as we say. This living person gives us certain sense impressions, sight, hearing, touch, and so forth, and displays certain modes of behavior, certain qualities, to all of which we give different names. And we say that we know this because we are conscious that there is so and so in front of us or speaking to us. Consciousness is one of those elusive terms which has come into being with no specific meaning. We cannot know what consciousness is in the ordinary sense of the word know. We only experience certain facts, and as one of the ingredients of that experiencing, we say that consciousness is at work. Now, if you take a living person, you will see that that living person is the integration of what we call material and mental. You can have a more extensive classification, if you like, a more extensive classification in which the word consciousness is included in the category of mind. This is discriminative consciousness, as we call it. When one realizes transcendence, discrimination ceases in your awareness. Now, I'm using a wrong phrase when I say your awareness. It is not yours specifically anymore. It is total consciousness functioning through that living organism, which is named according to whatever your name is. So now, if any of these different aspects into which we analyze the living whole person were to disappear completely, all the rest goes with it. This is rather a hard pill to swallow. One likes to feel that a part of oneself, some mysterious something, some power, some force, some spirit, some soul, some consciousness, survives. But consider very carefully. Finitude, measurability, separate objectivity does not belong to that which is other than the world of what we commonly call matter. Therefore, when this living person as we say, dies, the discriminative consciousness which manifested through this living person disappears with that death. Our terms, mind, matter, feeling, spirit, soul, have all arisen because of the analytical activity of our minds. And this analytical activity is present because we are at our present stage, in which we are considerably conditioned, our understanding is limited, and so we tend to regard the analytical components as either mortal or immortal. Since we cannot deny the evidence of our senses that when a body dies, that physical body has completely died and the thing disintegrates altogether, we say, oh, the body dies, and then we arbitrarily assert, but that something else continues. And why do we say that? If you look deeply enough, you will find that there is the fear of the unknown. There is the desire for ego perpetuation. But is this true to facts? That is quite a different matter. So, the question should not be worded that way. What happens to consciousness, only partly developed, after death? This, which is an integral part and parcel of totality, is still within totality, in completely changed forms, which are unidentifiable. This is the point. None of us can be thrown out of the cosmos. None of the component elements making us up can be annihilated. They are transformed. Take, for instance, a seed. You plant a seed in the earth, and it becomes a tree. Supposing the seed were self-conscious, like you and I are self-conscious. And the seed said, oh no, I won't give up my seedhood. Will there be a tree? You see? It's a very difficult thing. We want something for ourselves, as we say. But ourself is a misperceived and a misconceived self. At the back of our minds is the feeling, the desire, the idea that this which I call myself has something permanent in it through time and space. But time and space themselves emerge and are experienced by you and me in the manner in which they are experienced, simply because you and I are what you and I are. The truth, the absolute truth, no one knows. I certainly don't. It is only a relative vision, a relative understanding. But get free of bondage to your own selfhood and the clinging to this little thing that we call oneself. And the mystery of the unfoldment will take place. And totality will realize beatitude through you alive, and also after death without you. Now, do you still want to survive? If so, I'm sorry, I can't help you. See, the Buddha said, there is neither survival of personality, nor is there annihilation. Our intellects, working within the limited bounds of analysis and mechanical synthesis, cannot penetrate that. Realize the stillness and the silence, the utter purity and the quietude, and then realization of a nature so profound will take place that, like the Buddha, all that you will be able to say on this question is that there is neither survival of personality, nor is there annihilation. Only the totality is. Now, this question, do physical exercises help meditation? Are they essential for meditation? There are two aspects, broadly speaking, to meditation. One is what one may call 24-hour meditation. And this is the aspect which is continual mindfulness. To be mindful from moment to moment of all the sense impressions that come to you, mindful of the reactions that take place inside yourself as a result of those impressions. Now, you have to be mindful in the right way. Be mindful throughout the day without judgments. Be mindful in terms of pure observation, with an open mind, ready to learn from moment to moment. You will see for yourself, this at this moment appears to be good, or at this moment appears to be evil. Don't grasp at what you feel is good. Don't fight against what you feel is evil. Because the moment you take sides, you are caught in the trap of separativeness. You will never find harmony, wholeness, holiness, peace that way. You won't even begin to understand. Because only when one is free from taking sides and therefore prejudging the issue in some way or other, is it possible for the mind to be clean enough to perceive the situation or whatever is happening in its wholeness. That is the beginning of understanding. And in that type of mindfulness, you are free of the conflict of the dualities which make up our ambivalent life. Otherwise, you will always be storm-tossed. So this is one broad aspect of meditation, this continual mindfulness, without taking sides, without getting attached without feeling aversion. If the feeling arises, observe it. Don't say, I mustn't do this. I was told that this is bad. That's no use whatsoever. If you do merely what you're told, you will remain a slave forever. You have to realize, make real from within yourself. And that cannot be done by just taking somebody else's words or ideas and treating them as if they were your own living creation. So now, that's one aspect of meditation. There is the other aspect, which is the specific aspect, the one which most people think of when they use the word meditation. If you have the Eastern method, well, you sit cross-legged or whatever it is, you go through certain set practices as such. If you have the Western method, you have other ways also. The Christian churches, for instance, they have lots of techniques of meditation and so forth. In some respects, quite similar to the Eastern ones. In other respects, they vary according to the place, the tradition, the situation, and so forth. Now, here, you deliberately become self-contained. You deliberately, say, enter a room or some quiet place, and you sit and compose yourself, as we say. You become continent, self-contained. In order to maintain this continent state, the body must not obtrude itself upon the subject of your attention. Now, you know, we all know too well how, if we really want to be still and quiet, suddenly all sorts of rumbles take place inside us and all sorts of itches arise and sneezes and coughs galore and all the rest of it. The 15 billion cells of the body all rise up, you know, like unruly children at school and say, listen to me, I want this, I want the other. This is how the body behaves, like an unruly child. Now, this is where the training in postures and so forth comes in. And the actual systems which we have in India are very efficacious indeed. This is not to suggest that other systems are not also efficacious. Of course they are. But they are very efficacious in producing, above all, a calming of the nerves. Also, they train the body physically, muscularly, in such a way that the body can stay calm and quiet without obtruding itself upon your attention. Now, you can bear that out as a fact, won't you? So, the exercises as such, which are designed for this purpose, are indeed helpful. And if you like to take it to its end point, they are perhaps essential. When the body is sufficiently quiet, the nerves are calm, the breathing is rhythmic, gentle, then the whole mind gets unified. The clamor of the sense consciousnesses the obtrusiveness of the storehouse of mental impressions, the vasanas as we call them, which have accumulated all our lifetime, the personal unconscious as Jung would put it, and so forth, all those things do not rise up and disturb your attention. If they do come up, and in fact they will, then they will come up in the right way. That is to say, not causing conflict, they will come up for inspection. Again, somewhat like a child brings his homework to the teacher for inspection. Now in the quiet, you can inspect them and trace them to all the qualities and forces that are operating in your own nature. Your ambition, greed, resentment at frustration, ignorance, stupidity, egoism, and all these things. Therefore, you come to know yourself exactly as you are. Now, when this process goes on in the right way, what in India we call the burning up, the becoming incandescent, the tapas, takes place. Now just think of Moses and the burning bush in this connection. Now when this tapas takes place, and all that in itself is represented in the one word evil-mindedness used in the Upanishads, when that goes on, the psychical energies which are locked up in evil forms are transmuted into psychical energy for the absolute good, which transcends the ambivalence of good and evil which we ordinarily know in our everyday life. So you see, one of the deep things that happens in real meditation is this sort of thing. You will appreciate now why I repeat almost every day the necessity for complete purity beforehand. Because there is nothing at all in all this for me, the separate self, to gain or attain or achieve, etc. Nothing at all. The process that goes on here is a process of continually dying, wholly and completely dying, to the immediate now and all that it contains as it becomes the dead past. And if I know the art of dying that way, then for the first time I shall wake up to the reality of eternal life, which is not a thing of the perpetuity in time and space, which means in limitation, but the unlimited thing. And this can be done only if I pay total attention to the immediate now. And specific meditation of this sort, coupled with the mindfulness I spoke of before, together release that faculty in you for total attention now. Because gradually all your greeds, your grasping at this, that or the other, including God and transcendence and all the rest of it, all that disappears. Then, when there is no selfness, the self has become the pure vehicle for transcendence itself, then you will know that ye are the temple of the Most High, to use the biblical phrase, or to use the Upanishadic term, Shiva is the dweller in the temple. So for this end, physical exercises, the yogic postures and so on, are essential. Or at least one can say they are extremely helpful. Oh, would you say something on meditation? I've just talked a bit about it. That's the next question. Type of mantra used. Mantra, the word of power. You know, if you really want to know something about this, study some of the short Upanishads which deal with mantras in the group of Yoga Upanishads. It's very difficult to get any translation of them, English translation of them, very difficult indeed. But they are called Minor Upanishads. And there you will see what exactly is implied in the use of a mantra. The word as spoken, the sound which comes out of the mouth of a living person, is just a sound. And as sound, it can produce a sensation. Pleasant, unpleasant, frightening, calming, soothing, etc. If you suddenly growl at your little infant, you'll terrify it. But if you speak very soothingly to it, it will smile back at you probably. But that is just at the level of sensation. What has that got to do with the real mantra? The real mantric effect, and this also applies to ceremonials and rituals, religious rituals, congregational worship and all the rest of it, the real effect of the mantra depends upon the psychical forces that emanate from you because you are what you are, actually, and your attention is so in tune with ultimate reality. I don't like the phrase in this context, but it happened to come up, therefore I used it. Your attention is in tune with ultimate reality. That is why the mantric effect is produced. When, for instance, your Christian priest says, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, if that priest has himself realized in deep measure the meaning of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, out of his living being emanates a psychic force which works an extraordinary magic for good upon the listener. See? But which priest can do that nowadays? You listen, for instance, to the way that prayers are mumbled by most people. In India, I have heard Brahmin priests, Zarathustrian priests, Buddhist monks, there they go on, you know, just gabbling away. It's useless. But if you have realized what is involved when using the words, what is involved as regards the state of your own being, then you can use a mantra if you wish to. But if you approach the use of mantras with the intention that it will produce a beneficial result for me, then keep away from it. Because, you see, sound in itself has an influence. And like meditation, sound intensifies the psyche and all that there is in the psyche, good and bad alike. You might like to see the credit side of your bank account grow. But if you do things which make both the credit and the debit side grow, well, then you're no better off. And see, people don't understand this. Energy is just energy. It's neither good nor bad. Depends on us. So attend to purification first and foremost, and leave the mantra alone. Then you will find that you will utter words which are only prophetic speech and not useless chatter. And that prophetic speech will have power with it. This last question: do you maintain that all religions are basically identical, and that therefore there should be no religious conflict, only an approach to perfection through yogic channels, whatever the religion? Religion is one only. And religion is the expression of the religiousness that lies inherent in us. The different religions which we have in the world, in terms of their doctrines, their teachings, their rituals, and all the rest of it, are the external garbs of this living reality which is religion. Just as each one of us has several different suits which we wear on different occasions, this one reality of religion has several different garbs throughout the world. Now this is most valuable. If we had a characterless uniformity of expression, life would be deadly dull. It is this variety in expression that makes for the zest of that which appears in the world and passes away. The forms in which we find the reality of religion presented all undergo change, don't they? If you make a careful study of the theologies of the great religions of the world, from the time when they were first promulgated to the present day, you will find that all those forms have undergone change in the course of the centuries. So the outer form doesn't matter so much. The inner reality is what matters. And as far as that inner reality is concerned, the important thing is this: individual human beings so lived and so understood and became so purified that through them transcendence came to flower. And it is that fundamental living experience which is the source of all religious teachings. And the teachings therefore must necessarily be different in their forms, because this happened in different parts of the world with different cultures and different ways of life. different modes of development and all the rest of it. Hence the difference. Now, to say that only an approach to perfection through yogic channels is true in a sense. Yoga is that which you do in order that realization may take place. Whatsoever the way of realization, as I said in the talk tonight, that way of realization is yoga. No specific, particular form of yoga is exclusively yoga. Yoga, as I said in the talks in April, is a restoration of that which is limited, finite. It's a restoration of that into complete and perfect relationship with the immeasurable totality. So you see, if you understand the question that way, perhaps you will find light. And then this phrase, an approach to perfection. I would rather put it this way. We are alive now, this moment, and it is this immediate moment is what matters. Because this immediate moment, moving into the past, is dead. The future is not here. If I preconceive perfection, I have bound myself. How do I know what is perfection? I don't. It emerges. It happens. This is the great mystery. This is the significance of transcendence, of immensity, of that which man cannot fathom. So let me not make a picture of perfection, but let me so live now that perfection emerges. Haven't you watched a rose blooming? Does either the bush or the bud say, I must become like this? If it did, and if it could become like this, you wouldn't look twice at the rose or ever have a sniff at it. It would be something distorted. Look at the distortions that flourish all over the world, brought about by those who want to be like such and such a fan, or I'm a star, or so and so. Just distortions, aren't they? Rubber stamp copies at best. Dead. Worthless. Just live. Be. And the reality of perfection will emerge out of you all the time. Don't measure it. Don't try to look at it. Remember this story of the prince, of the charming prince who came as a lover every night on condition that she never sought to find out who he was or see his face. And one day curiosity got the better of her, she lit a lamp, and he vanished forever. Bliss disappears then. Don't try to look at bliss. And similarly, don't try to predetermine perfection.
It just remains for me to say a few words of most grateful thanks to Mr. Mehta for another wonderful talk. I always feel when I've listened to him that I've heard something which it was most essential for me to hear in order to develop and to be aware of what I am doing. And this, of course, is what we are all constantly trying to do, to be aware of what we're doing. And I think just being aware of this talk this evening will bring great blessing to us all. And I'm sure we would like to say bless you and thank you very much to Mr. Mehta.